Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. 75 years ago, the U.S. altered world history by dropping two atomic bombs on Japan in the closing days of World War II. The true toll of that decision and its effect on civilians and the environment was not known for many months. It took an enterprising journalist and his gutsy editors back in New York to get the story into print, despite the threat of censorship and worse. Today, John Hersey's Hiroshima remains required reading for students across the globe. Leslie Bloom's new book about the dropping of the bomb and Hersey's journalistic coup is called Fallout: The Hiroshima Cover-Up and the Reporter Who Revealed It to the World. Leslie Bloom, welcome back to the Roundtable.
So glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
So last time you were on the show, we were talking about your book on Ernest Hemingway and The Sun Also Rises. What got you interested in this story, John Hersey and the bomb?
Well, I knew that I wanted my next nonfiction book to be about a historical newsroom. I had personal reasons for wanting to do that. I have been, frankly, quite outraged and disgusted by the attacks on our free press over the last 4 to 5 years, and the designation of journalists as quote unquote enemies of the people. And I really wanted to find a historical newsroom narrative that drove home the extreme importance of free press, of investigative journalism, and really fine reporting when it comes to holding the powerful to account. I also knew that I really wanted the story to be based in World War II because I have an affinity for research in that conflict. It did take a while to find specifically the Hersey narrative because, I tend to be geared more towards, the European theater of the conflict. I didn't know a lot about the Pacific theater. My husband, who is also, a newsman, suggested to me, well, why don't we look at the logistics of how Hiroshima and Nagasaki was covered? And when I started researching that, I came across Hersey's narrative and realized that the backstory had not been sufficiently told. But what I also realized was that the resulting reporting that he did, Hiroshima, which revealed not only the human toll of the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but the fact that the U.S. government had covered it up, it was the perfect story to tell the story, the kind of story that I wanted to tell in terms of the crucialness of the press as a pillar of democracy.
All right, let's get back to Hersey in a second. I wanted to ask you about that because it's a subtext of the book, but you don't make it explicit until the epilogue when you talk about the importance of press freedom, your own background as the daughter of a journalist. What parallels do you see between the story that you cover in this book and what we've gone through in our country over the last few years?
Well, look, I mean, making it an explicit point about the importance of the press, within the current environment, it was a difficult decision to actually put this in the book. But ultimately, my editor and I decided that it was an important thing to do, to call it out directly. But that said, I feel that readers, would have, inferred the message of one of the messages of the book anyway as they're reading it. And that is, the book documents, an occupation press and, the Japanese press as well, who were, suppressed under occupation forces and unable to report the true story from the atomic cities. And here we're looking at a press that was, bullied, threatened with revocation of accreditation, and really kept under thumb in so many insulting but deeply effective ways. And the world would not have known right away or, in a timely manner about the true human toll in Hiroshima if John Hersey hadn't been able to get in and reveal the truth to the world. The Japanese press and, Japanese citizens were under a press code for years during the occupation. They weren't allowed to publish any aspect of their own experience as the only human beings on the receiving end of nuclear attack. They couldn't even mention Hiroshima in poetry, much less press reports. And it really did take, a foreign reporter to get in and get out and tell the story. It even took a year after the bombings to get that true story out.
You cover in the book the the way that the press had to operate in Japan, the American and the foreign press, they were supposed to turn in their copy to the censors, and it was even difficult to physically access places within the war theater or the once the war had ended, the former theater. So what was the setup like for foreign reporters, and how would you characterize early coverage of the bomb?
Censorship was wartime censorship, that is, was officially ended in fall 1945, for the most part. But the fact is that the U.S. and Japan were still technically considered to be at war. And the occupation press corps, that is, foreign journalists who came in with, you know, allied occupation troops, were still, you know, in a basically an embed situation when they were on the ground there. A few of the early journalists who came in with the first waves of occupation troops, they knew that the story of what it looked like on the ground in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were going to be huge stories, absolutely the hugest of the war. And they did vie to get into those cities. Three had early success. One was a Japanese-American journalist who had actually been stuck in Tokyo for the duration of the war. He got into Hiroshima. He was actually looking for his mother who lived there and had miraculously survived. And he gets out an initial UP wire report saying, look, this city of 300,000 people was devastated by the single weapon. There's some kind of affliction that's killing blast survivors. Maybe it's gas given off by the bomb. He didn't know yet. And so that wire report went out, but it was weirdly edited when it appeared in major publications in the U.S., such as the New York Times. The second reporter who gets in is a really salty Australian war correspondent called Wilford Burchett, and he managed to break away from his press minders and the occupation forces and make his way to Hiroshima at the end of August. And his was probably the most seismic first report that came out. He managed to report through Morse code back to an editor in Tokyo who managed to get his report over to London's Daily Express and break the story that a, quote, sinister disease X, as they called it, was ravaging blast survivors, and to confirm the extent of the devastation. Now, that was it for the U.S. government and MacArthur's occupation forces. They were not going to have another embarrassment like this. A third reporter in the meantime named George Weller, who is from the Chicago Daily News, had gotten into Nagasaki and tried to file a similar report. But his was duly intercepted and quote unquote lost. And after that, you know, the atomic cities were quickly made a restricted topic. MacArthur's occupation forces were extremely efficient in locking down the country and locking down the movements of journalists. You had to apply for permission to even travel from Tokyo anyplace. Eight or nine months later, when John Hersey gets into Japan, you know, not only do you have to apply for permission to travel, but they give you X amount of time on the ground in your destination within Japan.
Now, Hersey, he had a history himself with MacArthur. And in fact, The New Yorker only got the story because Hersey's relationship with Life had faltered. So how did it wind up that Hersey sought out the true story of what had happened at Hiroshima?
Well, you know, the four running reporters who we've just been talking about, I mean, these guys were really trying to evade occupation forces and getting the story. And, you know, they were what might be called, you know, unilateral reporters as opposed to embeds. And, you know, a couple of them had already been locking horns with MacArthur's censors for years as they were covering the Pacific Theater. You know, Hersey, on the other hand, he was what I have described as the perfect Trojan horse reporter in a way. I mean, Hersey was a seasoned war correspondent. He was a good war correspondent, but he was also quite cooperative, as many war correspondents had been during World War II. He did a lot of flattering military profiles for his publications. He wrote a quite flattering, you know, early mid-war biography of General MacArthur and his forces, which Hersey said later that he wished that he could take it out of print because it had been too laudatory. But, you know, when you're looking at applying for clearance to come into MacArthur's Japan, the fact of that very flattering biography is definitely going to be an asset. So I think that occupation forces, you know, if they're considering his application for clearance into the country, see him as being more of a team player, more innocuous than some of his four running reporters who had tried to get the story from the atomic cities.
Now let's talk for a minute about the setup at the New Yorker's offices. You describe it as kind of, a little bit of an upstart in those days, not known for doing stories like this necessarily. And you had, of course, Ross and Sean shepherding the magazine. So what was their vision of what Hersey should do on the ground?
Well, you know, The New Yorker had been founded 20 years earlier as a sophisticated humor magazine. And Harold Ross, its founder, who's quite a character, one of my favorite protagonists in the book, used to panic when it got over a certain circulation. He said, "What are we doing wrong? Too many people are reading this." So it was quite niche. But both Harold Ross and his deputy editor, William Shawn, they were both newsmen also. They had both started out in newsroom. They had both, you know, done coverage during World War I. And once Pearl Harbor happened, you know, they immediately turned The New Yorker to what they called a wartime footing. And, you know, even though it had been a humor magazine, you know, Harold Ross lamented nothing feels funny anymore. So they had dispatched correspondents for very fine reporting around the world. But after the war ended, you know, the big question came, you know, do we return to what we were, or do we continue more along the vein of what we were doing in the war? You know, the gravitas had become quite addictive. That said, they were still an extremely upstart operation compared to, you know, mega news operations like the New York Times or United Press or, ABC. And when they figured out that the reporting out of Hiroshima had been suppressed and that, you know, people around the world knew about the extent of the landscape devastation but not the human toll, the newsmen in these editors really came out, and they knew they had the opportunity to tell, you know, not only an outside atrocity story that might have gone otherwise untold, but also they knew that they had their teeth on what was one of the most incredible scoops in modern history, because in a sense, Hiroshima and Nagasaki were the most covered stories of the war, but they were also among the most covered up. There was never a real question that they would not buy to send Hersey in and try to get the truth out.
One of the innovations that you write about was Hersey's idea to approach the storytelling a la The Bridge of San Luis Rey. So how did he go about reporting the story once he was on the ground in Hiroshima? Who did he talk to, and how did he get around to meet people?
Well, look, you know, I think a problem with a lot of the reporting and the lack of comprehension of the extent of the tragedy surrounding Hiroshima and Nagasaki was that the stories had been told from a very, you know, God's eye point of view, the mushroom clouds, the magnitude. You know, for Hersey, he wanted to not only get behind that imagery to, you know, the human vantage point, but he also wanted to humanize the casualty statistics. We will never know how many people died in Hiroshima, but the statistics, the estimates go from 100,000 to, there was one report early on that said could have been 280,000. So he wanted to get in on the ground. He was going to have to earn the trust of blast survivors, interview them, and pick a handful of testimonies from regular folks who had been the victims, among the only human victims of nuclear attack in history. And, you know, his idea was that, look, I mean, not everybody can comprehend the physics of what makes the atom bomb work. Not everybody can comprehend what, you know, all-out nuclear global warfare looks like. But anybody can relate to the story of, you know, a young mother, a young clerk, a young doctor, you know, somebody going to work on a bus or a train, you know, in the morning when all of a sudden catastrophe strikes. He really wanted, Hersey really wanted his readers to experience the events of August 6th, 1945 through the eyes of people like that. And he, on the ground, spoke with several dozen blast survivors and ultimately picked six to tell their stories.
We're speaking with Leslie Bloom about her new book, Fallout, The Hiroshima Cover-Up and the Reporter Who Revealed It to the World. The production of the special issue of the magazine was done basically in secret, and I can identify with the fact that there was also a blown deadline involved there. How did they go about putting this special issue together, which, you know, didn't involve any of the normal cartoons, dispensed with the other features in the magazine, and get it to the newsstands?
Well, you can imagine how it would have looked for readers to be reading this horrific story about the truce of nuclear aftermath, you know, and having it run alongside, you know, cartoons. It's not exactly, you know, a happy mixture, right? But the fact is that the editors and Hersey, they really did create the issue in almost total secrecy. And I liken it in the book to their own version of a journalistic Manhattan Project. Hersey took his interview notes out of Japan, and he wrote the first draft of Hiroshima back in New York. And then he and Harold Ross and William Shawn, his editors at The New Yorker, edited it in great secrecy, locked away in Harold Ross's office at the sort of wonderfully shabby offices of The New Yorker. And they worked on it and worked on it, and you know, the contributors to the magazine and the other staffers were reportedly kept working on a dummy issue. So they're working on an issue that's not going to run. They're submitting all of their copy. They're not getting any responses back from their editor. So they know something is up, but they don't know quite what. And most of them would have to find out, along with the rest of the world, when the August 31st, 1946 issue is released, and it contains almost exclusively, wholly devoted to Hersey's article.
I was trying to think about what the equivalent in 2020 would be with an article like this. You know, it probably, you'd see it trending on Twitter when you woke up that morning, and maybe the author would be on half a dozen podcasts before coffee time. What was the impact when that issue hit the newsstands in 1946?
Well, I mean, two things on that. I mean, first of all, you know, Hersey was not on a gazillion podcasts, or even he didn't do a single interview at the time. He did not promote his article Hiroshima. He felt that the work had to speak for itself. And you know, Hersey was quite a celebrity, intellectual celebrity by the time the story came out. And he was movie star handsome. You know, one of his books had been made into both a movie and a Broadway play. He had been invited to the White House. He was in Winchell's column. I mean, he feared that he would be a distraction to the extremely important work. So it kind of fell to Harold Ross and William Shawn to handle all the publicity when Hersey left town. Hersey, when later described in a rare interview that he did give, he described the reaction to the story as, quote, explosive. Now, that's not a word that I ever use in my book for obvious reasons, but, you know, it was a huge reaction, an international furor. Because Hersey had not only really delivered a deeply empathetic, narratively addictive, and graphic account of what it had been like to be on the receiving end of nuclear warfare, but not only that, he had embarrassed two other very important entities, A, the U.S. government, because it showed his report, Hersey's report, showed how much had been covered up about Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the year since. And also, it really embarrassed other members of the press, because other people in the press had, from much more powerful organizations, had had the opportunity to tell the story or try to tell this story, and they hadn't taken it. So this was you know, just a blockbuster of a release, unlike, it's hard to think of, besides Watergate, maybe Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which has also appeared in The New Yorker. It's hard to think of a report that had a bigger immediate effect.
One thing I learned from your book was that it took quite a while for copies to get into Japan itself, especially Hiroshima.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the six protagonists, you know, who Hersey profiled, some of them didn't even know that the article existed. They didn't know that Hersey had indeed been able to write it. And when the New Yorker team is trying to get copies over to them, they end up having to send them through to a church with copies earmarked for, you know, the foreign nationals who were at the church, because Japanese nationals wouldn't have been able to read this under the press code. Anything, you know, any kind of reading material that violated what the press code called, you know, the public tranquility was not allowed. So, you know, the copies that were sent to Hersey's protagonists were sort of contraband, you know, but they did eventually get their copies. And I was curious to see how the protagonists felt about Hersey's depiction of their experiences. And, you know, later on, a few of them were able to give interviews, and they said that the ones who were interviewed said that Hersey had remembered and depicted their experiences with remarkable accuracy. So they were, you know, for the most part, very, very proud to have been involved or been featured in that particular reporting. And, you know, albeit a little bit inconvenienced because later on, because they were so famous after that. You know, while the occupation was still underway, you couldn't interview them. But after the occupation was over, you know, every year on the anniversary of the bombings, reporters around the world would seek out, you know, these six protagonists. And some of them were advocates by, you know, in later years, but some of them were just really living very humble private lives. And but, you know, being a part of Hersey's Hiroshima really did change their lives forever.
One of them is still living today, and you dedicate the book to her. Tell us about her life in the years since the book and how that has impacted her life over these 75 years.
Well, one of Hersey's primary protagonists is Reverend Kiyoshi Tanimoto, and he was not only one of the featured six protagonists, but he also was a huge help to Hersey on the ground. He made introductions for Hersey among other blast survivors, and he had also studied religion at Emory University, so he spoke English and wrote very good English also, too, which it was a big break for Hersey to have this kind of translation help. It wasn't his only translation help, but it was important. Reverend Tanimoto and his wife and his then-infant daughter, Coco Tanimoto, who was then 8 months old on August 6, 1945, are all in the book. And Coco is the person who we're talking about now, to whom my book is dedicated. She was a source for me on the story, obviously deeply versed in her family's experience on August 6th. She had been in her mother's arms in the family's house, not very far from the hypocenter of the detonation of Little Boy, the bomb. The house had collapsed on top of them. They were absolutely buried in debris, but it had survived. The mother managed to scratch a hole out through the debris, push Coco out, and then they both managed to escape the ruin as a wall of fire was consuming their neighborhood. It was a miraculous, completely miraculous escape. Coco, in the years since, like her father, has been, you know, a lifelong peace advocate. If you look her up, you know, if you do a Google search on her, you'll see she's done countless appearances around the world. She's, you know, a beautifully spoken, composed, just a really lovely and very convincing woman. But she's also 75 or 76 years old right now. She was, you know, an infant when the bomb happened. And, you know, she really is among, you know, the last of the bomb survivors, and their voices are dying out. And so it felt more important than ever on the 75th anniversary, when attention is being focused on the events of August 6th and August 9th, 1946, to really heed her story and the story of her family once again.
How's her health? So many of the people who were featured in John Hersey's book and also in yours faced numerous challenges throughout their lives due to that radiation exposure.
You know, I have to say, Coco seems fine. And when I visited with her in Hiroshima, and I, you know, we retraced Hersey's steps, we visited a lot of monuments together. I had a hard time keeping up with her. She was actually quite energetic, and you know, she was quite funny. She has you know, quite gallows humor, and her mother Chisa also lived to a pretty advanced age. I think died not too long ago, and Coco told me that they used to grimly joke that the radiation had actually had the perverse effect of preserving them. But she seems mercifully, she seems fine, and again, just extremely devoted to getting her message out about the extreme peril that nuclear weapons pose to human civilization.
So just a couple more things. You mentioned earlier that Hersey had some ambivalence about the story and, you know, the attendant fame and attention that it drew. He did go back several decades later to do some follow-up reporting on the story. What effect did he think that the book and the original article had on the world, if any?
Right after the success of his story in 1946, you know, Harold Ross did, you know, ask if Hersey would be willing to go back and do a reprise story, and, you know, the answer was a hard no. You know, and it took Hersey 40 years to go back, and he did eventually go back for The New Yorker to report on, you know, four decades later what had happened to his six protagonists and what had happened to Japan and to Hiroshima. And he wrote at one point that what had kept the world safe since Hiroshima from nuclear weapons and nuclear warfare, from another such nuclear attack taking place, was the memory of what happened at Hiroshima. And obviously he played an enormous role in bringing to the world, you know, our version, you know, our collective memory of Hiroshima and what happened there. You know, so in that sense, you know, he was proud of the role that he had played in creating what he saw and what other people, many people, have seen as a deterrent to nuclear warfare, just because we now know what nuclear warfare really looks like, thanks to him, and, well, partly thanks to him. He was worried by the 1980s, by the time he, you know, went back in to do his second round of reporting there, that the memory even then was starting to grow thin about what it really looks like to, you know, again, be on the receiving end of nuclear attack. And if the memory of Hiroshima fades, does it lose its potency as a deterrent? Well, of course, that's a real danger. And, you know, there are studies now that show that as the memory continues to grow thinner, that there is an increased public tolerance for the idea of preemptive attack, even largely civilian populations of enemy states. So I don't think Hersey was being unreasonable in his worries about the loss of potency of that memory as a deterrent asset.
So I want to end on this point. You know, we're accustomed to hearing today when an unflattering piece of journalism comes out that it's fake news or coming from a position of bias. You cover what the Truman administration did in response to Hersey's article, which was to effectively commission and plant a counter narrative in a different magazine. Do you see any connections between that approach and what we've seen from this White House in terms of unflattering stories?
Well, look, you know, again, we all look at history through the context of our present, right? And so when I first started researching the story, I assumed, look, there had to have been a discrediting effort, you know, because if that story came out today, we would have, you know, President Trump coming out and saying fake news. This guy's been, you know, a loser from the beginning. You know, I mean, his total, you know, liberal bias, which is, you know, probably a polite term for how he would put it. And so I had assumed that there would have been some kind of discrediting campaign against Hersey and maybe even his protagonists. I called up CIA records. I called up FBI records. And, you know, there really wasn't an attempt to undercut him directly. In fact, they took a kind of the U.S. government and former leaders who had been involved in the Manhattan Project. They took a weirdly elegant approach to try to discredit the report, or at least counter the report and regain the narrative, or regain their footing with the narrative. And that is, they did indeed, as you say, put out a counterpoint article in Harper's Magazine, and they chose Henry Stimson, who was the former Secretary of War, as the alleged author, although it was written by many hands. One biographer called it the old boy. The War Department network had everybody had a hand in it. Stimson had been a savvy choice to be the figurehead author on that article because he was supposed to have what was described once as an almost painful integrity. But the ostensible purpose of the article was like a clinical statement of why we dropped the bomb. And they were really just trying to shift the narrative away from the human toll that had been levied by these then experimental weapons, by bombs that continued to kill long after, you know, they were detonated, to sort of a clinical discussion of the bomb actually saved lives. It was humanitarian because it saved American lives, it saved Japanese lives, it cut the wartime down considerably, it sped up the surrender. It never made any mention of the word radiation. Stimson basically said, look, you know, yeah, people die, but the face of war is death. You know, so it was a shrug in that respect. And also it didn't ever address the fact that the U.S. government had indeed covered up this information about, you know, the radiological effects of their weapons, again, used on a largely populations that were largely composed of civilians. And even though it did assuage some American consciences in terms of, well, yeah, okay, you know what, actually, yes, it was horrible, but we did need to use the bombs, it never did erase, it never could erase the image that was now associated with nuclear warfare that was in part and, you know, at that time predominantly created by Hersey's reporting on the ground.
The name of the book is Fallout, the Hiroshima Cover-Up and the Reporter Who Revealed It to the World. We've been speaking with Leslie Bloom. It's been a pleasure to have you on for all of this time, and thanks for the book. I think it's interesting reading at our moment as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.